Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me as always, my partners in crime, Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hi, welcome to the podcast.
And Nick Newman, an associate editor for the Film Stage.
Thank you for joining us.
Very cordial day. For anyone just joining us for the first time, just wanted to let you know that the Film Stage Show is a movie podcast where we discuss a recent or current release. And we'll be doing a main review of that, and then we'll be giving you our selections for movies coming out on DVD and in theaters in the week ahead. But before we get into that, we do have a brief movie discussion every podcast. Today we're going to be talking about sophomore film efforts by prominent directors, because this week we'll be talking about Seven Psychopaths, which is the seventh film. That would make no sense at all. This is the second film by writer-director Martin McDonagh, who previously did In Bruges, which was a really great film. So we'll see how he holds up against the curse of the sophomore slump, and we'll also see how some of our other favorite directors did. Before we get into that, just want to say real quick, if you're listening on iTunes, you should definitely give us a rating and a comment. If you're listening to us randomly, you should subscribe to us on iTunes and then give us a rating and a comment. And you can always get in touch with us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So let's jump into our discussion topic. We're going to be looking at the second directorial efforts of some prominent directors and just trying to see, you know, how they fall in our spectrum of expectations and whether or not we think they are good or bad or in between or showed promise or perhaps showed that the Emperor indeed had no clothes. So, Nick, why don't you start us off? Give us an example of what you deem to be an example of the sophomore slump, some movie that didn't quite live up to the expectations set by the first.
We were discussing this beforehand, and for some reason, even though sophomore slump is a well-known, slightly common phrase, we couldn't actually think of real sophomore slumps, maybe that just says something about our brain capacity. I don't know. But my pick for a sophomore slump was a slightly obscure one. It's a movie called Les Petites Soldats, which in English translates to The Little Soldier. That's the second movie by Jean-Luc Godard. It was his follow-up to Breathless. And it's very strange to watch that movie after you've seen not just Breathless, but also many of the other films he made around that period, because it's a really sort of like amateurish trifle that's practically just a propaganda movie pertaining to the Franco-Algerian conflict. And I remember watching it and feeling very confused as to what I was seeing. You know, I was thinking, did he actually make this? Because it's so bad. That was one example of a sophomore slump. And then I was kind of thinking to myself, past that, we kind of talked about The Brothers Bloom, which Rian Johnson followed up Brick with. And I said that that's not actually a sophomore slump because it's, to me, they're about the same quality. They're both good, but not exactly standouts. So those are the only words I can come up with right now. So someone start speaking, please.
I call Danny. Danny, speak.
Well, to kind of go off Brothers Bloom, I think what that movie represents as a sophomore effort is kind of, regardless of what you think of the movie, I think it's important in the sense that it represents a director who's showing a lot of range in kind of his style, because tonally, to me, it's a very different movie than Brick. Brick is kind of like this film noir set in the present day, and there's a lot of clouds, and it's just kind of a very kind of dark movie. And Brothers Bloom, I mean, you could argue that it has dark moments, but it's almost like just a tourist trip, and it's a lot more light on its feet. I think that another movie that's similar in that sense is Sam Mendes' Road to Perdition, in terms of representing kind of an atmospheric shift from his first movie, which was American Beauty. And I happen to like both of those movies a lot. And if you see where he's gone since then, from things like Away We Go to Revolutionary Road and now Skyfall, you can see that that was kind of an accurate indicator of the sense that he doesn't really want to make the same movie twice or do the same thing over and over again. And I think that's kind of one of the things I like to look for in sophomore movies, is kind of a sense of range and a sense of wanting to kind of expand the director's vision.
Yeah, there's not a lot of American Beauty in Skyfall. Just
maybe I can imagine.
I think American Beauty should have had more Skyfall, frankly. But anyway,
that would have been incredible. Yeah, I mean that was the problem coming into the discussion, looking for indications of like great dramatic drop-offs in quality. I don't know what the hell the sophomore slump is even talking about anymore. I always just kind of took it as golden, but looking at a lot of the directors that I like, I mean their second movie seems to usually be better. I love The Brothers Bloom. I know that it commercially didn't probably fall within the range that they were hoping for, and it does showcase what some might call the worst tendencies of the director, Rian Johnson. But I dug it. I enjoyed it. I didn't have a problem with it. Road to Perdition, yeah, I liked that movie too. But it was another one of those things where people seem to just have this opinion about it. So I guess going off of other people, those would be the two that I'd bring up the most as far as being less than what you were hoping for. But for me personally, like I can't think of anyone who's really let me down like that. Which, considering that that's what we were going to talk about, kind of leaves us in a poor spot. But we can get into some directors who went off with their second sophomore effort, well, their first sophomore effort, their second feature, and really wowed us and kind of galvanized our already high hopes for them in their careers. And I'll kick us off in that regard, because my second favorite movie of last year was Shame by director Steve McQueen, who had previously done Hunger. Yeah, Shame. I've seen Shame probably like 8 times now. And considering that I don't get a lot of free times to rewatch movies, that's a little bit of a miracle. And it just shows how much that movie means to me and how much I connect with it and how great I think it is. There's not like a single scene where I just like, oh, I've seen this before. I could probably fast forward to the scene I like. No, I stay through the whole thing. I love every minute of it. In fact, it's weird because the only movie that beat it last year, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of quality was Tree of Life, which was directed by Malick, whose second film was Days of Heaven. And that is another just spectacular film that builds on what Badlands, his first film, had done and just really proved him to be a master craftsman. Anyone want to disagree with me on those two films or offer up their own choices for some really great sophomore efforts?
I think both are great, but I do prefer Hunger to Shame, personally.
I can get behind that.
So
I understand people think that, but I own both. They both get heavy rotation.
Yeah.
This is like a personal question. Is there a particular reason that you prefer one to the other?
I prefer the stylistic tendencies of Hunger. I like the opaqueness of it and the lack of traditional character development or anything like that. Not that Shame necessarily has traditional character development, but the way Hunger goes about in telling its story, it's, for me, it's a more satisfying visual experience, I think, than Shame.
No, but I can get behind that. I mean, Hunger is definitely the more stylistically audacious film, I guess would be the way to put it. The way that it starts off and you're following one person, and then it moves with a grace throughout this entire tapestry of the abuses of these prisoners. And yeah, there's not really a character arc. You don't really meet even Bobby Sands, as you're going to learn to know him as the hunger striker, until like the movie's like 2/3 over. I don't know. That kind of audacity really does help it stick out. But I don't know. Still like Shame a lot.
Yeah, and Days of Heaven is probably Terrence Malick's best film, so can't dispute.
And what are some other films that in our search really set you up? What are some films that you thought were really great second features?
One that stuck out to me was David Fincher's Seven. One of the reasons I like that movie even more now is because with what he's done recently, if you look at like Social Network and Dragon Tattoo, there's kind of a obsessive kind of tendency to have every shot be perfect. And there's almost kind of a lack of humanity in that kind of style. And I think Seven has a lot of moments of kind of messiness that probably resulted from the fact that he was really young in his career when he made it. But I think it also adds kind of more depth and emotion to the movie. I mean, the more I go back and rewatch his last couple of films, the more they just feel like a guy trying to set up a perfect frame. And it kind of takes some of the punch out of out of the story and the characters for me. But I mean, I think that might just be a personal thing because he is.
I've kind of that too, though. Like, I know what you're talking about. Like, he's a very his stoicism and his perfectionism kind of sucks the air out of some of the stuff he makes.
Mm-hmm. And that's almost one of the reasons why I even kind of prefer the original version of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, because it's clearly made by a less brilliant filmmaker, but in a way that almost makes the material resonate more because he's not trying to kind of dominate it.
Yeah.
You preferred a bland TV movie to David Fincher's?
Well, no, I think the material is meant for kind of a bland TV movie and not like kind of made for a perfectionist filmmaker. I think that movie, especially for me, is just there's a total disconnect between the talent level of the director and what the material calls for. And that's one of the reasons it kind of turns me off.
Sure, but this is a completely different discussion. But I feel like if you compare just individual scenes from either, there is no comparison. But
I don't know. This is getting slightly off topic, but I do want to say, like, Fincher's sterility and his clinical setup, like, it does sap. I mean, the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is pulpy as shit. Like, let's be real here. It's not a good or original story. And I don't think that his cleanliness serves it well. You know, it's like dressing up a hog.
Yeah, and I think if you look at some of the scenes in Seven, they're just like dirty and in a good way. And it's not he lets shots kind of sit longer, and it has more of an atmospheric power, I think.
Yeah, but I think Dragon Tattoo, the sterility is a very large aspect to the thematic backbone of the film.
we could get into you know, if they make a sequel, are they still making the sequel?
Think it's just maybe different strokes.
Yeah. Let's close out this
discussion.
What were
discussion. We talking about?
I was about to say, let's close out the discussion by getting back on topic.
Topic and, films, sophomore films.
Yeah, let's throw
Shame.
Out real quick some
right,
of our...
Right, okay. Maybe I'll jump off
there. Let's throw out, because we've run, you know, we've been talking about this for a pretty long time. Let's just throw out, like, sort of rapid fire some of the
We've
best.
Been talking about it for 9 minutes. It's not that long, but...
Really? I have us down as being recording for, like, 13 minutes.
Okay, whatever.
just to kind of keep the ball rolling on the actual topic, let's throw out some more of our favorites.
Okay. Pulp Fiction, Quentin Tarantino's sophomore effort, also my favorite film of all time, so that kind of has to get mentioned, I guess.
Definitely.
Magnificent Ambersons, Orson Welles' follow-up to Citizen Kane. You know, not easy to follow that up, but it fits the bill, you could say.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you had mentioned that Spielberg's technical second theatrical effort was Jaws.
Yeah, that's correct.
Which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely nuts.
I mean, he had directed other things before, but in terms of theatrical features, it was Jaws, which I don't know how that happens.
And Darren Aronofsky did Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, that's definitely up there.
Yeah, fantastic film. And it's actually... I don't know. It's a little disquieting because he actually said that he watched it after doing like Black Swan, and he like doesn't even recognize that filmmaker anymore in himself. Which I don't know. To me, is a little bit of a loss. Danny Boyle did Trainspotting second after Shallow Grave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that film. He's actually managed to keep, I think, his energy and his tone pretty consistent. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Joe Wright, who did Atonement. And I love Atonement, and I know that not everyone feels the same way, but I wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, he also did Hannah. Remember that movie?
I loved Hannah.
Hannah is garbage.
It's so well done, though. No, I mean, like,
it's not. It's posturing pig shit. But
oh my god.
Well, that's a different discussion. Whenever I get the chance to insult Hannah, I take it.
Okay, well, you know what? Maybe we'll try to work that into our review when we're talking about Anna Karenina in a month or so.
We could talk about Joe Wright.
Yeah, we'll just talk about the films of Joe Wright. So if you want to hear Nick and I come to blows over Hannah, tune in for that episode because that's going to be awesome. Danny, you got any others you want to throw on the bonfire?
Yeah, I'd throw out Gus Van Sant's Drugstore Cowboy. That's a really good movie. I haven't seen his debut, which kind of makes it funny that I'm recommending it as a sophomore feature, but it's really good. Todd Field's Little Children, I think, is... is really good. And it's as opposed to things we talked about earlier, it's more of kind of a stylistic and thematic continuation of his first film, In the Bedroom, but it's really effective. I'd also say probably Boogie Nights is a pretty good movie.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's kind of, I guess, fitting for as of late. It's a movie that's been coming up a lot recently, so you know.
Yeah, Boogie Nights is fantastic. That was actually on the other day, and I was watching it, and I just... I don't know, that movie, like, all of his films just have this tendency to absorb you. You're like, yeah, I'm kind of tired. Oh, this is on. I'll just watch until I fall asleep. And then it's 3 a.m. and you have to work in 4 hours. And you're just like, God damn it. Why you got to do this to me, man? Any final ones or any final thoughts that we want to put out there before we talk about the sophomore effort that's going to be the feature of this show?
It's a shame that Todd Field is yet to follow up.
Yeah.
Although he's got a movie that's going to start shooting in a few months with Christian Bale.
Yeah, let's get that on the move, Todd.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, speaking of Todd Field, Stanley Kubrick, we talked about how even with his second movie, Killer's Kiss, he still hadn't found his stride, which is pretty interesting. It wasn't until his third movie, The Killing, when he started to get a better footing. Because, I mean, Fear and Desire is okay. It's not nearly as bad as he thought it was, for instance. But Killer's Kiss, it's like a 65-minute sort of attempt at noir. And it's fine, but it's interesting how he would go on to be one of the most acclaimed filmmakers of all time. But even he didn't knock it out of the park right away.
God damn it, Stanley. Hit the ground running. yeah. All right. So that's what our thoughts are. If you have any sophomore features that you think we missed, or if you'd like to tell us any that you thought were bombs that we missed, you can always write to us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Until that point, however, it is time to get into our feature review of Seven Psychopaths, which came out last weekend, and it should still be in theaters by you.
And how's everything in the dog kidnapping business?
Hi, is this your dog?
Oh my god. Oh, I have to pay you. Thank you so much.
Are you serious?
Not boring business. I ain't talking about that shit neither.
Mr. Costello, please don't hurt me.
Where were you walking him, Charisse?
You love your dog so much, Mr. Costello, when you're such an angry type person. You just think it was my fault and drag me back here and tie me up and kill me.
Yeah, that was a pretty good. Yeah.
I always loved Bonnie like he was my own child.
One, I do not want that image in my head. Two, could you go get my fucking dog back?
So Seven Psychopaths, if you've been looking at the marketing for this film, you're wrong. Whatever you think this movie's about, you're absolutely wrong. The marketing is very, I think, purposefully deceptive. This movie's about a struggling screenwriter named Marty, played by Colin Farrell, who is writing a film called Seven Psychopaths, and he is having trouble coming up with said Seven Psychopaths because he doesn't want it to be a violent film. But he can't change the title. And he hooks up with his friend Billy, who is in a dog kidnapping hustling ring with his friend Hans. Billy is Sam Rockwell. Hans is Christopher Walken. One day they kidnap the wrong dog, and shit gets real. So... yeah, thoughts on Seven Psychopaths. And why don't we start off also, before getting into our thoughts on Seven Psychopaths, by talking about how we felt about In Bruges as well. So, Nick, why don't you kick us off?
In Bruges was a movie that I remember really looking forward to because I like that sort of film. And I like what I thought that sort of film was. I was pulled in by the trailer. And I remember seeing it and quite enjoying it, but being very taken aback because it wasn't at all what I had expected. It was a much more somber and thoughtful film than something like a Guy Ritchie movie, which, you know, again, I enjoy, and that was part of my initial attraction, but it turned out to be something different. And that's a film that you talk to a lot of people who see that, and if they've only seen it once, they'll say, oh yeah, I thought it was pretty good. But if you talk to people who have seen it more than once, they say it's great, like myself. Because it was a movie that really grows on a second or third or even fourth viewing. one that you realize as you're watching it that it's a very – it's a much stranger film than you even realize initially. There's a lot going on the fringes of the story. And Seven Psychopaths is actually pretty similar to that because I saw this movie in early August before there were any trailers or really any reactions at all. So I had no idea what to expect. And again, I was thrown off. I wasn't anticipating something that had sort of the qualities or ambitions of adaptation. And perhaps that – I'm sure that colored my reaction to the movie in some sense. Maybe it colored it more than either of you because you had heard some things before you saw the movie. Maybe you saw a trailer. I did like it, and I thought it was very funny. And in that sense, it's already a success. And I do find the self-reflexive aspects of it to be rather interesting, if not entirely successful. And I feel like the discussion should kind of branch into that later on. But for the most part, it gets a thumbs up.
Yeah, I don't think we have any choice but to get into that sooner or later, because it's funny, like you were saying with In Bruges, like on the surface level, yeah, it's a good film, but the more you watch it, the more you realize that it is actually like a great film. I went into it, I'm sure for the reason that most people went into it, it seemed sort of like a Guy Ritchie film. It seemed like, you know, an energetic, fun, darkly comic romp around the underworld, and it turned into something so much more. And so going into Seven Psychopaths, I knew the marketing was probably not telling me everything, but I didn't realize the level to which it wasn't telling me everything. You're right to compare it to adaptation. It definitely does have that vibe to it. I know I enjoyed it, and I know that I will see it again. And I think that everything on a surface level works really well. It's a propulsive, interesting, fun, you know, sometimes thrilling, sometimes moving, you know, film. And I just don't know how well it carries off the other elements that it's going for. So yeah, I've got to be kind of on your level with that. It's still a huge thumbs up for me. But I think until I give it the amount of attention that I gave In Bruges, I almost won't even be able to say how well it pulls off some of its meta self-reflexive elements. But Danny, what did you think?
I'm pretty similar to you guys. Sorry if that makes for a boring discussion. But I really do respect In Bruges the more I watch it. And I do think Seven Psychopaths, to kind of connect this to our earlier discussion, I do think it's a bit of a slump in terms of it feels like he's kind of getting by on the fact that he's just a brilliant writer. So the movie works because it's just hysterical and the dialogue is great. And he's actually a very good director too. But one of the things that holds it back for me is that it doesn't really have like an atmosphere. I don't think if you rewatch In Bruges, like Nick mentioned the word somber, and that really does kind of inform like every frame of that movie. It's very sad and kind of full of despair. And Seven Psychopaths kind of jumps all over the place. And that's appropriate in the sense that it's very self-reflexive, like we've talked about, and it kind of hops around from character to character. It's a much larger ensemble. But I also think that that also makes it a little bit more forgettable in terms of it throws a lot at you, and a lot of it's funny and entertaining, but it perhaps doesn't stick quite as much as In Bruges.
Unfortunately, I have to agree with you. In Bruges, one of its greatest strengths was that atmosphere that it wrung out of that crazy medieval city. This one, it almost seems like a conscious decision to go the opposite direction of that, because they spend a great amount of time in this movie sitting in the middle of a desert. And, you know, as beautiful as deserts can be, it is like the antithesis of the city of Bruges.
Yeah, I think one aspect of this movie that disappointed me was, weirdly enough, the cinematography, because In Bruges is a very beautiful-looking film, and it's sort of a movie you could watch the background of it at any given moment and find something interesting going on, particularly toward the end. But Seven Psychopaths doesn't really look that nice. It has a very generic visual palette to it, not necessarily in terms of the actual direction, but just the cinematography. It felt too digital, frankly, I thought.
I can get behind that. It does. You know? No, that's it's something that I hadn't thought of on my own, but, you know, thinking back on it, yeah, you have a very valid point there.
Which might have something to do with the the Los Angeles setting, because it has sort of a, because Los Angeles is kind of a, I think, a much more drab place than a lot of people realize or are willing to admit. And so perhaps it fits into that in a certain sense, but yeah, I don't know. It looked a little, it was much less lush than his prior effort.
Yeah, so visually not as interesting. I think that the level of writing, though, remains the same. I mean, this movie is, you know, just as, if not more, quotable and enjoyable on a pure, like, almost radio play level. The opening conversation between two hitmen standing on a dam was incredible.
Yeah. Was not expecting, a Boardwalk Empire reunion there, either. That was really weird that those two actors show up.
And they're not in any of the marketing, so I was just like, no. Oh, shit, these guys are in it? That's awesome. And then they're not in the movie. They're not in the rest of the movie. I guess this is as good a time as any to get into spoilers. Just because the marketing has been so opaque, and I feel like we've actually done a decent job of bringing our thoughts on this to light without getting too spoilery. So, Seven Psychopaths, not what you expect or would think from the marketing, but still very, very worth your time, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah? Everyone in agreement?
Oh, definitely.
See this movie?
And right. I would say maybe see this in the theater if you can, to give it a little bit of a box office uptick so Martin McDonough can keep working.
That's a running theme through the podcast lately. It's like, please go see this in the theater. We need these people to make money.
And this movie hasn't been doing well, unfortunately.
Has it been doing poorly, or is it just kind of middling?
Yeah, it hasn't been doing great.
That's not good. Yeah. So
here comes the people made more.
Get out there and see it.
Ooh.
It did come out the same weekend as Argo.
Yeah. It was supposed to come
out. Argo had a great second weekend.
It did.
Yeah.
It was supposed to come out November 2nd, which I feel like would have perhaps been a better fit.
Yeah. I don't know why they pushed it up. In Bruges, I don't remember how well it did, but it's grown. And I feel as though this will probably have the same fate. So, and if it doesn't, I mean, Martin can always go back to writing plays, because those were pretty acclaimed and pretty successful. So he'll always be out there somewhere for us, but we'd really like to continue to see him on the big screen. That being said, let's get into spoilers, which will allow us to talk more about those crazy meta elements we'd been talking about. Nick, you seemed pretty gung-ho to get into that, so why don't you kick us off with your thoughts on those?
Yeah, I think, like, the best, even though this is not among the best, like the best meta aspects to any film. As I was watching Seven Psychopaths, I was trying to figure out how much of Martin McDonagh's own life and experiences were informing what I was seeing on screen, because the movie is about a screenwriter. Actually, it's about an Irish screenwriter in Hollywood named Martin writing a movie called Seven Psychopaths. And there's a very interesting convergence and confluence of what would appear to be real life scenarios and what's clearly from a screenplay. In fact, the opening scene I thought was going to be a movie in a movie when it started. I was like almost 100% sure that it was a movie in a movie, because it feels like a parody of gangster films in a lot of ways, modern gangster movies, which it very well may still be, but it's under a different context, obviously, by the time the film progresses, and then it's something is revealed about that opening scene, or light is shed on it. And yet, I don't know, something about it didn't quite gel. And I think it was sort of the fact that the movie is operating on more than two levels, which I don't think is always a wise decision. There's something more like three or four layers to what's happening here. And the more you sort of the further you go into that, the less interesting it becomes, I think. I think the weakest scenes are the ones that have technically nothing to do with the plot, ones that feature Harry Dean Stanton and Tom Waits.
Really?
You think those are weak? I didn't particularly like them. I thought they kind of weighed the movie down and they halted the momentum. Oh. They felt incongruous to what was happening otherwise.
I don't know. Those were... I'm not going to say... Well, no, I'll say it. Some of my favorite scenes were those scenes. I don't know why for certain, but I mean, the Harry G. Stanton stuff was... I thought it was like comedy gold. Like, really, of course, really dark comedy. But, yeah, and Tom Waits' character has a great payoff at the end. And
Yeah, but even that scene, I didn't like that much. I kind of wish the movie didn't send me out of the theater on that note, frankly.
Really?
Well, the scene goes on for too long, and I think that is emblematic of those entire elements of the film. It feels egregious.
Danny, do you have an opinion on that?
Those scenes kind of played to me like a lot of the scenes in the movie, in the sense that I loved them while I was watching them. I think they were, especially kind of those flashback narrative bits, I thought they were really kind of beautifully staged and well written and very dark, but in an enjoyable way. But they don't really like leave you with anything, and they take away from the central aspect of the movie, which should be this meta thing. And kind of my problem with the movie is that it doesn't really commit to getting inside of Colin Farrell's head. It introduces the meta aspect, and then it just kind of introduces you to this ensemble. And when we're supposed to kind of, like Nick said, interpret things through these three or four layers, it doesn't really work. And I just think that if he's going to make a movie like this about himself, he should have really committed to that rather than making, you know, eight or nine other characters and telling us all of their stories that, you know, may or may not even be true. We can't even really tell.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. But I really liked the amount of depth he got into with some of the other characters and sort of fleshing out their lives, because I don't know, I feel like that was part of what he was trying to say. Like, you have a film, the idea of seven psychopaths, and it's weird, because it's almost like, in a really offbeat, kind of subversive way, it seems like the marketing is trying to sell exactly the type of film that Marty spends the entire film saying he doesn't want to make.
Exactly. It's selling, I mentioned it before, it's selling a Guy Ritchie movie.
Yeah. And
which is interesting when you think about how they sold In Bruges and now how they're selling Seven Psychopaths. There's kind of a weird three-way tie between them that I sort of like.
Yeah. And the weirdest thing is, like, he keeps saying this isn't the movie I want to make, but he keeps kind of getting pushed in that direction. You know, it's kind of like the it's kind of like the writer doesn't have the amount of control that he'd like, and he knows what's expected of him. And it's almost like in a world where Marty had been forced to make that movie that he didn't want to make, the marketing for it would be the marketing for this movie that's about a guy who doesn't want to do all that. So, like, it can almost make your brain hurt if you think about it too much in that way. And I don't know. I enjoyed it. I liked getting those glimpses at people, and I didn't mind the slowdown of the rest of the film. Because to me, the plot in this movie was almost incidental to the ideas and the explorations and this weird writer's college that he makes in the middle of the desert to try to help him with his movie as they're hiding out from a lunatic who really wants his shih tzu back.
Yeah. I think that...
You seem grudgingly to have said that.
Well, in terms of, like, the ideas of the movie, I think the most fascinating idea is that Colin Farrell, he not only does he not want to make a Guy Ritchie movie because he's like, he wants to make something kind of more profound, but he's against it because, like, the way he's wired, he's writing psychopaths comes natural to him, and that feels, you know, very autobiographical. But that idea just kind of gets lost, and I think that's kind of the coolest idea in the movie, is that you have this guy who really wants to write something human, but he's just wired in a way that he just writes about killers. And
but you don't think that theme kind of plays in with the storyline about the Vietnamese priest?
I don't think it plays in like organically. The movie to me just plays kind of like a lot of vignettes.
I think it plays very cleanly and coherently, and then it feels like vignettes when you get to those. Feel like vignettes to me. The thing with the Vietnamese priest or the Tom Waits character, even if they're funny, they're sort of a millstone around its neck.
I guess. I mean, no, I don't. I don't guess. I don't know. I don't know what to think anymore, because, like I said, I enjoyed those scenes. There's just something so weird and absurd and interesting about Tom Waits chilling out with a rabbit and telling this story about these terrible things that he and his wife, were they married or were they just boyfriend and girlfriend?
It's his girlfriend.
Okay.
I think.
I don't know.
I saw this over 2 months ago. Give me a break.
But no, I mean, I liked those scenes. I enjoyed them. I do think that in some way they may add a little bit of fat to this story that otherwise gets lost. But at the same time, I still appreciated them, and I enjoyed having them there with me in that moment. So yeah, I don't know. I can't defend it as well as I'd like to, just because it is such a personal reaction to something, you know. It's not like the lighting or anything. It really does come down to a matter of taste.
And I mean, like, I was definitely, like, engaged with those scenes, and I think that, you know, we haven't really talked about the acting much yet, but I think uniformly everyone is just brilliant, especially, like, Christopher Walken and Sam Rockwell.
Yeah, those two guys are great in this.
They're just incredible. And, like, while I was watching it, I was, you know, very into it. I just, once you kind of think about it, it doesn't have that staying power to me that In Bruges has. And it's hard not to, like, look at them in comparison to each other, especially with what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I don't know if this is going to, you know, if we were to have talked about this in our opening segment, I don't know that it would have been a slump film for me. I think that it may, however, kind of work its way into a Brothers Bloom type category where I love it, but I can see why other people would have issues with it, because it does seem like whatever restraint was present in Bruges kind of got knocked out the window here, and there was a little more free rein to throw in themes that might not have fit or ideas that might not have fit as well as they could have, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, the acting, I mean, Sam Rockwell is great. That guy, everything I see him in, and I just wonder why he's not more acclaimed than he is. And I don't know if it's because he's kind of like the weird Weasley guy, so he would never really be like a Brad Pitt level frontliner, but I mean, he's great. I loved him in this. And
what are we doing? Making a fucking French film here?
Oh, now you can finally say the thing, the Christopher Walken line.
Oh yeah, fuck the cops, fuck them. That's great.
I love the line when they're in the bar and Colin Farrell offers him a drink, and he's like, "Nah, I do peyote." It's just like, what? Yeah.
That's your Christopher Walken impersonation?
I guess.
It's not bad.
It's terrible. Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to try again. I'm just going to let that one live and die on its own.
Maybe at the end of this review, let's all three of us go around and offer an impersonation.
Of Christopher Walken?
Yeah.
From any specific film, or should we like say it in
our own way? Just say anything.
Okay. We'll do a say anything moment with our Christopher Walken voices. Other good actors in this film. Woody Harrelson turns in some good work. It's not as demanding, I mean, as you'd expect it to be, but still really, really fun to watch him do his thing. Colin Farrell plays Colin Farrell as Colin Farrell. Any thoughts on him? He is the ostensible lead of this film.
It's every performance you've ever seen from him, but yeah. I like it. I mean, I like Colin Farrell, so I didn't.
Yeah, no, I like Colin Farrell a lot too, so I'm good with it. I'm fine with that. It's not as nuanced or as I guess as meaty of a role as In Bruges was, but I still enjoyed it. I did. If there was one thing that kind of worked at me throughout the course of this film, everyone makes a pretty big deal about his drinking. And yeah, he drinks a lot, but I feel like if there's something that gets lost, it might have been that. Anyone else feel that way?
Because
there's a few scenes where he loses his girlfriend over his drinking. Like, he's got a drinking problem. But and then at some point he's like, I'm not going to drink anymore. But then he goes and buys a bottle of whiskey when he finds out that Sam Rockwell is the Jack of Diamonds killer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that was maybe just one piece of like the writer persona. It clearly didn't seem like he wanted that to be like one of the main subjects. It was just kind of part of his character, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that I might be tapped out as far as things to talk about for this film. Because sooner or later, I'm just going to devolve into saying like my favorite parts, like some, you know, sugared up 7-year-old who just saw Star Wars, which I think is a point in this film's favor. I don't think it goes as deep as it wants to. I think we could probably talk about themes and ideas in Bruges more than in this film. But I mean, it's still a great time at the movies. Did anyone else have anything they wanted to throw on before we moved on?
Looking forward to the third film.
Looking forward to that junior effort.
Apparently it's going to be about women, as our interview with him, which you can read on the site, revealed. He said he'll have the strongest female characters you've ever seen.
Good plug. We did hear that from Zack Snyder, though.
I like Sucker Punch.
Hence Man of Steel.
You like you do like Sucker Punch. Okay, one of these days when there's a slow weekend, we just got to like figure out all the films that we hate and love and then work out our issues. Because I fucking hated Sucker Punch.
I mean, I don't love it, but I do. I like it.
Okay. Well,
I love Watchmen. So.
Yeah, so do I.
Cool. I'm a Zack Snyder fan. Watchmen.
Yeah, so am I.
I don't apologize for that.
Man of Steel teaser is awesome.
Yeah, the movie's, you know, the movie's going to be just like that, too.
If this movie's taught me anything, it's that marketing is never misleading. It would be pretty cool to see, like, a Terrence Malick superhero film, though, so.
Yeah.
I mean, Malick, the way he's going, he should just make it, you know?
Can you imagine? Can
you're
you imagine? Let's just take a moment of silence to imagine a Terrence Malick superhero film. And we're done.
All right,
let's move on. Seven Psychopaths. Good film. Maybe not great, but still definitely worth your time. Go see it. Give Martin McDonagh your money. And now we can move on into what is coming out in the week ahead. Looking at Blu-ray.com, we got a lot of James Bond films, which is par for the course. So let's just skip over that. Re-release of Blade Runner.
Oh, because that movie hasn't had enough fucking home video releases.
Yeah, it's actually on here twice because apparently there's a box you can get that appears to have... I don't even know.
I just want to say, I actually looked up this on some website to see what the features were. There's actually less features than there was on the 5-disc Blu-ray set from 2007.
Yeah, that's so ridiculous. I don't know what they're doing. I honestly don't. Unless you want a car or you want a unicorn on the front of your box. I don't know. iRobot is getting released in 3D on Blu-ray, which is a thing that's happening. Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which I liked. I don't know. Did either of you see this film?
No.
Okay. No.
Jordan hated it, I remember.
Yeah.
But I really liked it. So, I don't know. It's going to be one of those movies people are going to like hold it against me. But I mean, it's a stupid, interesting movie that actually tries a lot harder than it had to on its premise. So I'm going to say you should check it out if you're looking for a fun night. Magic Mike, which we all liked, right?
Best studio movie of the summer.
Yes, definitely. See Magic Mike. Like, I don't... God. I feel like it sucks that I have to say this, but like, if you're a guy who's like, I don't want to see dudes strip, like, get over yourself and see Magic Mike. It's a good film. Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, I did not see. Did anyone here see that?
Yeah, I didn't see that either.
I didn't, but I kind of wanted to. It just sort of didn't fit into my schedule, unfortunately. Yeah. I'll check it out.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a review on our site. Wrong Turn 5. That's the movie everyone was begging for. Sunday Bloody Sunday is coming out on Criterion. You can get an iRobot 3D release with a robot head, if you're into that. And Tyra Perry's Medea's Witness Protection.
Let's move on.
Take This Waltz is coming out.
Yeah, I was going to mention that just because it's your second.
We did talk about that. And I didn't like that film that much.
I think it's an interesting film that doesn't really work.
No, it doesn't. Seth Rogen has a good performance, that's all I'll say. And
her next movie is supposed to be really good. It's this documentary called Stories We Tell.
Oh.
And I think it just got picked up for a 2013 release.
It's funny because that movie, we were talking about Sophomore Slumps. Actually, yeah, that's a good one. I didn't like Take This Waltz.
I was going to bring it up, but I guess I didn't.
Well, it's here now. And yeah, you didn't. It felt like a first film. It felt so half-conceived and poorly executed. I hated that film. The more I think about it, the less I like it. I almost want to see it again so I can be better at explaining why I didn't like it. But yeah, let's go into what's coming out to theaters. Oh, look. Cloud Atlas. What are our thoughts on Cloud Atlas? Because I know I've been pretty vocal about the fact that I think this looks like a heaping pile of shit. But,
wow.
I'm still going to go into it with an open mind. Don't get me wrong.
I'm sure you will.
No, I thought... This is another stupid example. I thought that Real Steel was going to suck, and I allowed that one to win me over. I mean, I thought Prometheus was going to be the best movie of the year, and I didn't like that film either. So I'm willing to let my mind be changed. I have no problem with the Wachowski starship. I really like Tom Tykwer. I love Perfume. I actually meant to buy that this weekend because him constantly being in the news recently has made me want to see it again. But what are your thoughts on this? Like, where do we stand on this to give us some context before our review next week?
I remember seeing the first trailer and kind of just going like, no, not going to happen. But as the reviews have come in, something about the negative reaction to the movie. Well, I'd say the reaction to the movie overall is not negative. It's mostly positive. But every review of the movie makes me want to see it more, whether it's good or bad, because it sounds it just sounds like a very interesting experiment and one that I feel like I will enjoy no matter how much I actually enjoy the film itself.
That's kind of where I'm at, actually. Like, even though I think it won't be good, I'm still looking forward to seeing them try that hard, you know?
Yeah, so I feel like I'm actually looking forward to the fact that the movie is almost 3 hours long, because I feel like it'll be fun to watch it unfold over that long a time span.
I am not looking forward to that, but that's something we can get into. Danny, you read the book, actually, didn't you?
Yeah, I read the book, and I can very clearly see a movie resulting that's a total mess, but I think it'll be cool. I'm looking forward to it. I think if you're skeptical, then you don't really get the themes of the movie, and you should rewatch the trailer, and then you'll see like everything is connected.
I understand everything.
Life, death, birth. Like, I don't. That's people who are skeptical don't really get that. You know?
Really? You're gonna call me out like that?
I mean, like,
here's my defense. I loved The Fountain, so.
Yeah, but The Fountain isn't about life, death, birth, and present, future, past.
Are you joking me right now? I was about to say.
But is everything connected in The Fountain?
No, and that might actually be what kills this movie for me, because I don't like that, like, neo-spiritualistic nonsense. But I'm willing to let it work on me. I'm willing to let it do.
Yes, but aren't you a Christian?
Yes.
Ah,
what does it do? What does that have to do with reincarnation and everything being connected? I never let my religious or political ideals influence what I think about a film.
Really?
No. Why would I?
I don't know.
Unless it's like a propaganda piece. Like, if it's trying to tell me that we should like invade Britain and take them over, then like, yeah, obviously I don't agree with that. But I mean, like, I can't even think of like a good example.
I guess I just feel like sort of your religious and political beliefs inform the way you view the world in a philosophical stance. So that should, I feel like that would influence your reaction to Cloud Atlas.
I understand that. And I mean, like, one of the reasons I like Tree of Life so much is, I think I've said it before on this show, that like, I can't come up with a better reason or an explanation for why I believe in God than what Tree of Life is. Like, its basic statement is, this idea of mystery and the entirety and enormity of the universe and creation. That just, yeah, that fits. So obviously I had a reaction to that, but also just on a technical level, it's a brilliant, interesting, audacious film. I mean, The Fountain, similar. But I mean, like, you know, my religious affiliation would say that, you know, having sex with numerous random people without love is wrong, but I still love the shit out of Shame. Like, you know.
I don't think a movie like Shame is necessarily affected by political or religious beliefs.
Wedding Crashers?
What?
Wedding Crashers?
What about it?
That's morally reprehensible. It's still funny.
Yeah.
I don't know. This will be something that I'm sure we'll talk about in Cloud Atlas. And we can spend the week trying to firm up what exactly we're trying to say. I don't know. Cloud Atlas is coming out. That's happening. And I'm actually a little bit dreading it because it is 3 hours long. And that's, should it happen that I do not like that film as much as I think I won't, I can only say that that will be hell for me. So time will tell. Chasing Mavericks, also coming out, directed by Michael Apted and Curtis Hanson. It's about Gerard Butler teaching a kid to surf. That's the thing.
Someone last night on Twitter said Curtis Hanson and Michael Apted have been making crap for the last 10 years. What if we put them together?
Curtis Hanson, I mean, that's a guy who I used to really like a lot. Like, he was great. What the hell happened to him? LA Confidential, Wonder Boys, like those were great films.
Yeah, and then he made In Her Shoes.
I was about to say In Her Shoes, Lucky You. I don't even know what the hell that is.
That's the movie one with Eric Bana.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sad.
Oh, Lucky You. That was so bad.
Get it.
And
together,
I actually watched that movie like right in the middle of, like, I had a poker phase in high school where I played a lot of poker. And so every hand in that movie is just hysterical. if you kind of know some stuff about poker.
Yeah. God, he did The Hand That Rocks the Cradle and The River Wild. Like, those were not great movies, but they were still fun. So that guy's got to get it together. Silent Hill Revelation 3D. I like the video game. The first movie wasn't complete bullshit. This one does not look that great.
I was sent an email to cover the red carpet premiere of that movie, believe it or not.
Don't tell me you turned it down.
I would have to go to Los Angeles. And
Dude, do it.
Honestly, it was on a Friday night, and if they like paid for my flight and a hotel, I might have gone.
I would have gone. That would
be so funny.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's based off of like the third game, it seems, just to me, and I didn't like that one that much, but who knows. Fun size.
The Hangover for Kids.
I was about to say, like, I don't even know what to say about that film. So let's not talk about it. So Cloud Atlas is the big one coming out. It's probably, I mean, I know we're going to cover it. It's inevitable. It's an inevitable film. So keep your eyes on that. Check it out.
Skyfall opens in the UK.
I don't live in the UK. I mean, I'm sure that we may have a UK listener. So, UK listener, you should check out Skyfall. Americans, you've got Cloud Atlas, or you could see Seven Psychopaths, because apparently you haven't done that yet. And now it's time when we give you our random recommendations of something that we watched this week. Danny, would you like to kick us off?
Oh, sure. Well, another movie that's coming out this week in limited release is Julia Lacto's The Loneliest Planet. And that's a really striking film. And this weekend I watched her previous film called Day Night, which is about a suicide bomber and kind of the days and hours leading up to that event. And that's another pretty incredible movie. What's interesting is that Loneliest Planet is about kind of this married couple hiking through these mountains. And so it's very isolated and there's no one around. And Day Night, the first half is kind of this woman in a motel room, and it's incredibly claustrophobic and driven by interiors. And then the second half, she's in New York City and there's people everywhere and she's kind of freaking out. So it's just interesting how this director has kind of grown in terms of where she's set her movies. So I'd highly recommend both of those films. And there's actually a really good quote by her. She said that the movie was inspired by this story about a woman who stopped for bananas before detonating her bomb. And she said that she wanted to make a movie about the bananas, not the bomb. So it is very much about this claustrophobic, intense buildup to the event rather than the event. It's definitely worth checking out.
Excellent. And Nick, what have you watched that you think we should check out?
I have a policy where I don't recommend rewatches for no good reason.
I was about to say, a policy that you've forced on yourself for no discernible reason.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's commendable.
I rewatched Close Encounters of the Third Kind last night on Blu-ray, and hadn't seen that in so long, and I forgot what a great movie that is. That's one of Spielberg's best films, easily. But the movie that I'm going to recommend has a weird connection to Close Encounters. The film I'm going with is The Last Metro, which is a 1980 movie written and directed by Francois Truffaut. The connection is that Truffaut is in Close Encounters, if you'll remember. He's actually the second billed actor, weirdly enough. So next time you watch that movie, look out for him. Anyhow, this is kind of a surprise for me because it sort of jettisons the low-key nature that I think marks a lot of his work. It's has this big ensemble cast, and it's surprisingly complex with how layered their relationships are and how they're bouncing off of one another and all that. And it's also a good World War II story as well. There's some Nazis, you got a little Gestapo going on, but it's mostly about the theater and about a love of the theater, which is something that I don't have personally just because I'm not associated with the theater, but I think the film has enough emotional truth in it that I could still connect to it and completely understand where these characters are coming from. So check that out. If you have Hulu Plus, it's on there for you to view.
Yeah, I actually saw that up at Lincoln Center last year. They're playing it. And it does feel a little bit kind of maybe light compared to like some of his other work, but it is very well acted and emotional.
Oh. Yeah, very pretty movie too.
Mm-hmm. All right, so make sure to check that one out. Personally, I watched a bunch of movies this week. It was weird. All of them, however, were things that I rewatched. So yeah, it's yeah. So I've got a couple of options. I could talk about Attack the Block, which I've bought on DVD from a grocery store for $5. It deserves a lot better than that, and I apologize, but it's a good film. I enjoy it. However, I'm going to bring to light something that I think is a little more esoteric. It's called Alice. It's from 1988, and it is from director... This is going to be another chance for someone to correct my pronunciation. Jan Svankmajer?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. And this is a Czechoslovakian film, I believe. And... yeah, it's a retelling, a new vision of Alice in Wonderland that involves a young woman. I don't know, she looks really young in this. I thought Alice was like a preteen, but this girl seems like she's 7. Yeah, she retreats into this fantasy world, only it's not like the cute and cuddly kind of Disney version. It's all built on these like taxidermied animals and like the stuff that's available in her crappy, like, rundown home. And it's just a really visually interesting film. And it's got this weird atmosphere to it. The White Rabbit is a taxidermied rabbit that comes to life and has to, like, pull the nails out of its feet to get out of its little display box and is constantly trailing sawdust and has to eat sawdust to, like, stay alive. It's so weird. There's so many like messed up things that are happening. I was watching with a group of friends and my friend Carly actually had to leave the room because she was just like freaking out so much by the oddity of the movie.
Is it animated?
It's stop motion.
Okay, because we watched in one of my classes last year, we watched a few works of his that were stop motion and they were very fun.
Yeah, no, it's so good. Like I enjoy... this film, and it was weird because the first time I saw it, I was like, well, that was odd. But I've watched it at least 3 more times since then because it really does grow on you, and this visual style that he has is so interesting. I mean, there's a scene where a mouse, like, it's a room filled with water because she was crying so much, and a mouse, like, swims over to her and crawls on her head and sets up, like, camp. And it's just like, where does that come from? And it's the animation is done in such a weird, like, surreal style. It burrows under your skin. It gets to you, and it's good. And hey, Halloween's coming soon, so if you're looking for an interesting film that's still a little creepy but not exactly scary, then yeah, definitely check this one out. But that is all that I have to say, and I do believe that means that we've come to the end of our podcast for today. So gentlemen, why don't we tell the fine people at home where they can find us on the internet in the meantime, and then we can sign off. Danny, would you like to start us off?
Oh, sure. TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And Mr. Newman?
TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And I am at DearFilm.net, also TheFilmStage.com, and on Twitter at Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. I also just remembered, hey, we didn't end our review by doing Christopher Walken impressions, so do we want to do that? We can say goodbye, our best Christopher Walken.
Thanks for listening, and goodbye next time. That was terrible.
I was about to say, that's like a carnival huckster. Would you like to try again?
Thanks for coming, and listen again.
Okay, that's better. Danny, what about yourself?
Hey, thanks for listening to our podcast.
That is your Christopher Walken impression?
Yeah, how was it? I mean, like, I've worked on it, so be honest.
Okay. All right. Hey, thanks for coming, and come back next week when we talk about Cloud Atlas.
I think that was probably the best one.
I mean, I don't know if that's a huge compliment. It was the best one, but
yeah,
it was definitely better than mine.
Yeah, well, that's all I strive for, is to be better than you. So, ladies and gentlemen, please do come back next week when we will never, ever again try to be Christopher Walken, but we will, in fact, talk about Cloud Atlas. And I hold nothing personally against the Wachowski starship.
Wachowskis. The Wachowskis, Mia Wasikowska?
Yeah, I know. I fucked it up. That's going to get edited out. That's our blooper. The Wachowskis? Jesus, what is wrong with me?
Wachowskis.
I've got no problem with Andy and Lana.
You were supposed to learn this in 1999.
I was, and then I didn't. So, Wachowskis. And I actually really like Tom Tykwer. I think
Tykwer.
Jesus Christ, German names. I never let my religious or political... I'm going to start that sentence over again.
I feel like a movie like Cloud Atlas would actually kind of influence... I feel like your reaction would influence... what the fuck am I saying?